makes you wonder why they stopped here. Wagon must have lost a wheel, or they lacked ambition one. In the great migration west, separated from the rest, though they might have tried their best, they never caught the sun. So they sunk some roots down in this dirt to keep from blowing off the earth. They built a town right here, and when the dust had all but cleared, they called it Level Land. The pride of man, Level Land. Granddad grew dry land wheat, stood on his own two feet. His mind got incomplete, and they put him in the home. And daddy's cotton grows too high, sucks the water table dry. His rolling sprinklers circle by, bleeding it to the bone.
Level Land with James McMurtry, one of my famous favorite singers. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker, right here in the bunker, right here in North Central Indiana on the 21st of September, 2021. How about that? Yep, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Yeah, and it's a beautiful day here in Indiana. Sunshine, warm, like Mongol summer. I mean, Indian summer. About that. We're back in the saddle, boys. Back in the saddle again. We've been running all over the place, escorting my grandson around, showing him the ropes, showing him the lakes, showing him the women. I mean, wait a minute, yeah. I was experimenting this morning trying to put video together. I thought I could do a show on video, but I don't think it'll be possible unless you use streaming. And because we can record, but they're too big of files. I ended up with a 40 meg file for only about a half an hour of video. So we're back to the microphone-y, baby. Well, let's get back to the Pessimist Guide to History. Yeah, you like that one. Blood and Power, Caligula's Cruel Reign. Well, now, I don't vouch for any of this stuff because it happened so long ago, who knows who dug up these so-called facts. You never know. Like Henry Ford said, history is bunk. A fortune teller once told Caligula that he had as much chance of becoming Emperor of Rome as he had of riding dry shod over the Bay of Fays. Upon becoming an emperor in 37 A.D., Caligula ordered ships anchored across 3 miles of the bay, had them covered with wood and dirt, and triumphantly rode his horse over them. Within a year of taking power, however, Caligula decided himself as a god and justified his incest with his sisters by citing Jupiter's liaison with his sister Juno. Along with this bizarre behavior, Caligula also became increasingly obsessed with killing for pleasure. Like I say, I don't know. Who knows what happened back then? He referred to Rome as the city of necks waiting for me to chop them. And his favorite method of execution was killing victims slowly by inflicting countless small stab wounds. At a banquet, Caligula once burst into laughter, saying, "It's just occurred to me that I only have to give one nod and your throats will be cut." Well, at least he told the truth. Finally, in A.D. 41, Caligula's guards assassinated him and his wife and beat his infant daughter to death. One of the world's most famous psychopaths. Well, there's been a lot of psychopaths since then. And most of them are in office right now here in this country. Caligula is a prime example of Lord Acton's statement, "Power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely." So that's why you don't want a federal government. No country should have a federal government. Okay, on to AD 64, the Great Fire of Rome. According to Roman historian Suetonius, in the summer of AD 64, the Emperor Nero's advisor Tigellinus quoted lines from a Greek play, quote, "When I am dead, may fire consume the earth," unquote. Nero corrected him, "While yet I live," unquote. Every contemporary Roman source, so-called source, you know how they talk about you and me, blames Nero for instigating the fire that broke out on the evening of July 19th, 2 days after Nero had left Rome for Antium, 27 miles away. Seemed to me he had a pretty good motive. Motives ascribed to the emperor range from a desire to rebuild the city in his own glory to simply a desire for dramatic entertainment. Well, if the city was burning and he was 27 miles away, how could that mean that he was wanting just entertainment? I think a lot of this stuff is, supposition. But whether or not it was deliberately set, the fire that consumed ancient Rome began in one of the shops that surrounded the Circus Maximus, a giant sports arena in the center of the city. Strong winds spread the blaze rapidly across the entire Circus Maximus area, where it fed on the flammable goods for sale in the shops, and moved inexorably through the narrow streets crowded with wooden buildings. Well, I know who started that fire. It was Christ Insanity, people. Yeah, read Gibbon's The Fall of Rome and you'll find out. The historian Tacitus, who witnessed the panic in the streets, described the terrified, shrieking women, helpless old and young, people unselfishly supporting invalids or waiting for them, fugitives and lingerers alike, all heightened the confusion. Mobs of people rushed to escape the advancing flames, but the fire seemed to follow them everywhere they went. Many finally fled the city altogether, though some lay down to die in despair after losing their families or all their possessions. I guess that's what a lot of people do in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan. They don't flee, they just give up and lay down and die. Wait for the next drone to come over and blow the shit out of them. The most ancient monuments of Rome, temples, shrines, and mansions went up in flames. Gone were Nero's place and the Temple of Jupiter, supposedly built by Romulus, one of the founders of Rome. Nero, awakened by a messenger with the news, journeyed back to the burning city that night. Sounded to me like he had a pretty good alibi. Legend is that the mad emperor stood in the tower of his gardens, gazing at what he called the beauty of the flames. Unquote. He then supposedly watched the city burn to ruins while playing the lyre and singing of the destruction of ancient Troy, thus originating the saying, Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Well, maybe the city was so engulfed with flames by then there's nothing anybody could do. So he probably just said, well, at least I'll play some music. I know a lot of people would do that here if it happened. For 6 days, the fires roared on unchecked. Tacitus reported that menacing gangs roamed the streets, the niggers of the day, threatening anyone who tried to put out the fire and throwing torches to spread its devastation. Perhaps they had received orders, he wrote, or they had just wanted to plunder unhampered, like they did in the Watts riots and Newark riots and Detroit riots and so forth and so on. After 6 days, the fire sputtered out at the foot of Equiline Hill. But new fires then broke out, reportedly on the estate of the emperor's advisor, Tigellinus, on the other side of Rome. The rumor spread that Nero had ordered the city burned because, as Tacitus put it, he was ambitious to found a new city to be called after himself. Despite the alleged villainy, Caesar opened his own gardens to those made homeless by the fire, and even had emergency shelters built for them. He brought shipments of food from nearby Ostia and ordered a reduction in the price of corn to feed the hungry masses. Doesn't sound to me like he was the arsonist. Of the city's 14 districts, 3 were burned completely to the ground, and 7 others were reduced to a few scorched and mangled ruins, according to Tacitus. Tacitus wrote that Nero blamed the fire on the Christians, and I think he was right, and used it in an excuse for horrendous persecutions, including having them torn apart by dogs or covered in pitch, and used as human tortures in his garden. Nero built himself a grandiose new palace called the Golden House of Nero, which had a 120-foot statue of himself at its entrance. At last, he said, I can begin to live like a human being. So that's the end of our reading today. Any place in history you find history and Christians involved, you're going to find a lot of lies, because after the Christians gained control, they began writing history the way they wanted to write it. And so I don't accept for fact anything anything that the Christians influenced. That's for sure. Well, let's read a few things that have come across the wire here. This is out of Russia. Quote, "Now listen, people of NATO. You're bombing a wall which stood in the way of African migration to Europe and in the way of Al-Qaeda terrorists. This wall was Libya. You're breaking it. You're idiots, and you will burn in hell for the thousands of migrants from Africa and for supporting Al-Qaeda. It will be so. I never lie, and I do not lie now," unquote. True, true, true. Here's another one. "Well, NATO needs to have continual crisis to justify its existence, such as 9/11 and Afghanistan. They probably need these migrants in Europe to later fight radical Islam." I've already started to hear the arguments that there may be ISIS operatives among the migrants. Well, gee whiz, I wonder why they would do that. Perhaps European industrialists want more low-wage labor to compete with Asia. The more failed nations, the more opportunities for intervention. There you go. Here's another comment. "NATO murdered Gaddafi. Now it wants to get at Assad using Daesh or ISIS. Another failed coup. Russia is behind him. I only wish Russia would have backed Gaddafi as well. We'd all be better off." And yet another comment. "Europe is finished with a whimper. Not because of neocon plots, but greed, slavery to American corporations, and helping wipe out whole countries. Millions of refugees from Europe streaming towards Russia next." Well, I see that a hedge funder, you know what they are, a former hedge fund manager, has turned pharmaceutical businessman and has purchased the rights to a 62-year-old drug used for treating life-threatening parasitic infections, and raised the price overnight from $13.50 per tablet to $750 per tablet. According to the New York Times, Martin Shkreli, he looks Jewish to me, but what do I know? 32, founder of and chief executive of a Turing Pharmaceuticals, purchased the rights to Daraprim for $55 million on the same day that Turing announced it had raised $90 million from Shkreli and other investors for its first round of financing. Daraprim is used for treating toxoplasmosis, an opportunistic parasitic infection that has caused serious and even life-threatening problems in babies and for people with compromised immune systems like AIDS patients and certain cancer patients, that sold for slightly over $1 a tablet several years ago. Prices have increased as the rights to the drug have been passed from one pharmaceutical company to the next, but nothing like the almost 5,500% increase since Shkreli acquired it. So there you go. Another good capitalist. Yeah. Now, but don't worry about it. The government will end up paying that for it and giving it free. So anyhow, that's the way pharmaceuticals work. They either kill you by taking the stuff or kill you by working so hard to make the money to buy it. Well, this mental midget Ben Carson, the Negro so-called neurosurgeon, which I don't think it's all the true stuff have come out on him, the campaign of a retired neurosurgeon and GOP president, hopeful, Ben Carson, defended the candidate's controversial comments on Sunday, implying he didn't think a Muslim should be president, NBC reported. Appearing on Meet the Press, Carson said, "I would not advocate that we put a Muslim in charge of this nation. What about a black Muslim? How about Mr. Farrakhan? I absolutely would not." After stating that he believed the person's faith mattered by saying, "I guess it depends on what that faith is," unquote. Defending Carson, Campaign spokesman Doug Watts said Carson will reach out to members of the Muslim community to explain his comments. How much explaining do you need on that sentence? Saying that they are being misinterpreted. And he was speaking of the American public accepting a Muslim president and not himself. Quote, he did not say that a Muslim should be prevented from running or barred from running in any way, Watts said. He just doesn't believe the American people are ready for a Muslim raghead president. Well, the Papa is about to come to the United States, Washington, D.C. first, where he can drive out the evil spirits. And I'm sure he can do it. And all you people, all you sinners out there, better get down on your damn knees and start praying your ass off, or you're going straight to hell because he said so. Because he is the vicar of Christ. He's the representative of Jesus, the non-existent Jesus. Well, we're going to have to put up with several days of this nonsense as the Papa Popa travels around the country. I don't know, maybe he's done it, but I haven't heard him attacking the super rich. I don't think he's going to say anything about the top wealth people ruling class in this country when he comes here. Well, why not, Papa? Well, are you getting trumped out by now? Is it getting to be? It's so ridiculous. There's something going on here. You know it, and I know it, or you should know it. It's not on the up and up. And Trump is playing a certain game, and he's probably put up to it by some very powerful people. Probably he's wanting to wipe out the Republican Party. I don't know. It was doing a damn good job itself, but maybe he'll speed it up. And that'd be all fine with me.
On Thursday, General Motors CEO Mary Barra held a 15-minute news conference in which she discussed GM's agreement to pay $900 million to end the U.S. criminal ignition switch probe. We let those customers down in that situation. We didn't do our job. And as part of our apology to the victims, we promise to take responsibility for our actions. So we accept the penalties being announced today, because that's what it means to be held accountable. But apologies and accountability won't count for much if we don't change our behavior. But we can be proud that we have. That's General Motors, CEO. And I want to turn to Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader, your response to the settlement.
Well, it's an absurd settlement. It doesn't deter future behavior by General Motors. Nobody went to jail. Nobody's indicted. The company wasn't indicted. The Justice Department, under Attorney General Loretta Lynch and the Obama administration, have created a new doctrine. It's called crimes without criminals. They charged GM with a crime, but the company was not indicted, and no officials were indicted. Imagine individuals being able to get away from that. That's a double standard between the privileges and immunities that are dedicated to corporations by the U.S. government and the way individuals are treated. It went so far, Amy, that there are motorists who were charged with vehicular manslaughter because they were involved in crashes due to GM's defect. As the corporate crime reporter pointed out, GM did the crime. The drivers do the time. And so I think the focus has got to be on Congress. The pending highway bill has to include criminal penalties for auto companies for violating safety standards for cars and parts if they do so willfully and knowingly. And so, as Rena Steinzer has said, they can be prosecuted and sent to jail.
Let me ask you about the Times piece today points out that the U.S. Attorney Preparara cited an internal investigation conducted for GM as favorable in determining the penalties paid by the automaker. The two law firms hired for that inquiry, King and Spaulding and Jenner and Block, had previously done legal work for GM, and court papers show Anton Valukas, the chair of Jenner and Block, who headed the GM investigation, helped represent the automaker in its talks with the Justice Department. Your response?
Well, as Professor of Law Rhodes from Stanford said, this is a strange situation where GM takes on an independent reviewer, Mr. Valukas. He puts out a report. It's quite condemnatory of GM's corporate culture over the years. And then he gets hired as the defense counsel against the Justice Department. That does not pass the smell test. There's a lot involved here, Amy. The U.S. taxpayer bailed out GM $50 billion after they collapsed in 2009 or so. And the government, in return for the bailout, became a 60% plus shareholder. So the U.S. government owned, in effect, GM. And what did they do for 5 years under the Obama administration when they owned GM? They did not restructure GM, requiring compliance officers, requiring independent ombudsmen so conscientious engineers in GM could go and tell the ombudsman about defects in cars without losing their job. They didn't do anything except bail out General Motors. And so they lost a great opportunity to also investigate this ignition switch. I mean, it was not a secret. GM has covered up this ignition switch problem, which killed at least over 124 people, since 2002. I mean, you have the classic conditions for criminal behavior. You have a known defect by people inside GM. You have deaths and injuries increasing. You have a cover-up. You don't tell the U.S. government, the Auto Safety Agency, in 5 days what you're supposed to tell them. That's another violation of the law. It was a cop-out by the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York under orders from the Justice Department and probably the White House. It was a cop-out. It's easy to go after people for insider trading, as this U.S. attorney does. But when it comes to really going down and enforcing the law against corporate crime, he backed down. And then he gives the excuse, says, well, you know, GM has this complex internal structure. We couldn't find out who was accountable. Nonsense. As Professor Steinzer has pointed out, they've done exactly this in other cases, but it was small fry. They went after some food company that contaminated people with deaths, and now they want to sentence the head executive of this small company to jail. But no, GM, bailed out by the U.S., subjected to all kinds of stagnant technology for 50 years, suppressing known safety defects, losing market share to foreign importers, and lobbying on Capitol Hill against criminal penalties, against fuel efficiency, while it was being bailed out, and then stonewalling the same auto safety agency under the same U.S. government that's trying to enforce the auto safety laws.
On Thursday, U.S. Attorney Preper praised GM for its cooperation with authorities.
From the moment that top management came forward to disclose the defect in February of 2014, the company's cooperation and remediation have been fairly extraordinary. It conducted a swift and robust internal investigation. That doesn't always happen, I can tell you. It gave the prosecutors in my office real-time updates about the findings of that internal investigation, often revealing to the office what witnesses had said even before GM management was filled in itself.
And that's the U.S. Attorney Preparara. As the New York Times points out, prosecutors focused their attention on a relatively short period of time, only 20 months from the spring of 2012 to February 2014, when GM began recalling 2.6 million older cars to fix the switch. But the complaints go back more than a decade, with a number of people inside the company saying that they were being told that they shouldn't raise this issue, Ralph.
That's right. It's a classic cover-up over a period of more than a decade, as the Center for Auto Safety has pointed out. But now, looking forward, what we have to do is focus on Congressman Fred Upton, the chair of the committee in the House, handling the highway bill as we speak, and Senator John Thune from South Dakota.
Oh, that's all bullshit. Didn't do anything. They're not going to do anything. Oh, man, the corporate state. The corporate state. That's what it is. It's a really, now Mussolini had sort of a corporate state, but this corporate state makes his look like a bunch of Boy Scouts. No, you just do like in China, the CEO of the company. He's the leader. He goes to prison or he's executed. If they knew they had a problem, 124 people died over this problem that GM had after we taxpayers bailed them out for, what, $10 billion? These attorney generals won't go after any big boy. No big fish are going after. It's going to be up to you, the people out there, someday. Pitchforks and torches, man. Go after that Frankenstein. Or is it Frankenstein? Well, the NFL football bum guys are mostly black, right? Well, how about this? In recent years, the National Football League has come under a controversial firestorm regarding the safety of the game. Many have been led to believe that the constant hits over a regular professional career have led to the disease chronic traumatic encephalopathy, also known as CTE. But according to a recent study by the Department of Veterans Affairs, this can very well be the cause. Partnered with Boston University, the two entities discovered that 87 out of 91 deceased players had the presence of CTE in their brains. Well, that's one way to get rid of those black boys. See, they don't have to get a Klan robe. They don't have to burn a cross. They just pay them a lot of money and let them go out on the football field. But the data did not stop at just NFL players. Researchers looked at a total of 165 individuals who played football at the professional, semi-professional, college, and high school levels. Out of that sample, roughly 131 players had CTE, or brain tissue. Not much room for anything else. That is alarming when considering that high school sports have been increasing for years. So, if you want to get rid of somebody, encourage them to go into football. Football. Even high school football. Mess their brains up, man. Well, Richard Sherman, a black guy from the Seattle Seahawks, made some comments here that made a little sense. According to Sherman, the Black Lives Matter movement should focus on black-on-black crime while discussing issues like police brutality. Quote, we need to deal with our own internet issues, internal issues, before we move forward and start pointing fingers and start attacking other people. Why, I think his brain hasn't got CET, and he's a football player. I get a lot of news reports on the KKK putting pamphlets on the porches all over the damn country. Do you think the NAACP is behind that? I begin to wonder. You know, the Klan is pretty much dead as a doornail. And considering its leadership, it should be. But somebody's got bound to determine to keep it alive for publicity reasons, I think. So maybe the NAACP or the Black Lives Now that are distributing Klan material throughout the country. What do you think? Now they're going to get your panties all twisted up by saying Carly looms as Hillary's worst nightmare. Brother, the media in this country is something else. Carly Fiorina is the one Republican that Hillary Clinton hopes she never has to face, BS, because Carly Fiorina can take on Hillary Clinton in ways that the men in gray suits and red ties can't, said Charlie Giroux, a GOP strategist who was advising Ms. Fiorina. Well, if you look into the past of Ms. Fiorina, you'll find out she's as corrupt as any of the men who are running for office, man. You got to know what she did. and what she did to the company she was leading as CEO. Believe me, unless it's a miracle on her side, she's not going anywhere. One reason is still women traditionally don't vote for women. I mean, sure, a lot of them will, but not enough. Well, here's a little tidbit. As seen as an aspect of his brutally absolutist German nationalism. For the Nazi dictator, the Germanic Aryans reigned supreme. Yeah. The theory goes, and Jews, Slavs, and Gypsies needed to be eradicated by this master race. Well, wait a minute here. Now, here we go. However, Yale University Holocaust historian Timothy Snyder has argued that Hitler's anti-Jewism was actually rooted in an even more extreme and far more sinister way of seeing the world. What Hitler does is he reverts, Snyder explained at the Atlantic last week. He reverses the whole way we think about ethics, and for that matter, the whole way we think about a lot of things. Hitler's worldview said, which Snyder termed racial anarchy. Human life has no inherent meaning outside of the savage competition between the races, he said. Oh, yeah, could be true. The Nazi dictator thought races struggled against each other, kill each other, starve each other to death, and try to take land. Well, it looks like only the top 1% do that. This is life. In Hitler's eyes, Snyder said, the Jews subvert this natural order by introducing the idea that people can see each other as human beings. Boy, what a clown. This guy is a slave to the kikes. It was to return to a state of nature, not for nationalistic reasons, that Hitler wanted the Jews wiped out. Wow. Let's see if I can get a little more of this. Snyder lays out these ideas in Black Earth, quote, "The Holocaust as History and a Warning," published this week. Well, I'm sure he'll make a lot of money, and they'll probably make a movie out of it. Talking to The Atlantic, he underlined one of the book's major points. Hitler's anti-Jewism went far beyond mere hatred of Jews. Snyder said that Hitler wasn't any more or less anti-Jew than Iranian Supreme Leader Anatoly Khamenei, who he noted recently predicted Israel's demise within 25 years. And I said that right after I got back from Israel. He stole my stuff, that Khamenei. The difference between the two leaders, he said, is that Hitler's anti-Jewism was his raison d'etre. What the hell ever that means. In fact, Snyder argued it would be wrong to even describe Hitler politics as nationalistic because the dictator didn't truly believe in the idea of statehood. Oh, Uncle Adolf, it's terrible. Quote, Hitler explicitly said that states are temporary. Well, they are. State borders will be washed away in the struggle for nature. Absolutely, Snyder said. His decision as Führer weren't truly concerned with the strengthening of the German state, but rather were designed to make Germany an instrument to destroy other states, absorb other states, really, in accordance with life's true primal meaning. Yeah, he was pretty right on that primal meaning stuff. As far as he was concerned, if the Germans lost, that was also a view that a nationalist can hold. Yes, it is. If the people aren't up to it and they're wiped out, you know, that's just one of those things. If we think that Hitler was just a nationalist, but more so, or just an authoritarian, but more so, we're missing the capacity for evil completely. This guy's got it figured out. Snyder cited Barack Obama's interview with The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg in August, in which the president argued that Khamenei's hate-filled anti-Jew ideology does not preclude him from making national decisions based on the principle of self-determination or preservation. Well, I agree. By comparison, Snyder said the supposed evil of the Jews was so central to Hitler's worldview that Final Solution was entirely rational for him. I can understand that to a degree because these other people don't want to give the Jews any... they don't want to say they do anything bad. They're just wonderful people. And Jews just don't do bad things. No. No. I mean, of course, you can read the Bible and see a hell of a lot of things they did bad. But they don't want to admit it today. All the Christians want to say, they're wonderful people. And they never hurt anybody. I can't understand Hitler and Germans getting mad. Well, hell, people were mad at the Jews all over Europe. Hitler wasn't the only one. Hell, they had the anti-Semitic parties and everything. Just another fish wrap book to throw in the trash. He'll probably make enough money to retire. Well, we got another little bit of Ku Klux Klan, black Ku Klux Klan activity here. Selma, Alabama is the site of another disturbing incident. You know, you can always tell when progressives are talking about blacks. Of a church shooting, however, this time the culprit was a black man, which we will hear very little about that. Yeah. James Jr. Mintner, 26, has been arrested after he opened fire during the services at the Oasis Tabernacle Church in East Selma, Alabama. See, that's the same area where the other guy, the white guy, Foot, shot the people, shooting his girlfriend, their baby, and a clergyman, according to the Dallas County District Attorney. Oh, Michael Jackson's come back to haunt us. Yeah, his name is Michael Jackson. The shooting reportedly stemmed from domestic violence between the couple. Oh, I thought it was over the parking place. According to witnesses, Mentor entered the church and sat in the front row between his girlfriend and their child while he pulled out a handgun and began shooting. His girlfriend, 24, fell to the ground, and Mintner opened fire on her, striking his girlfriend in the jaw and the shoulder. Mintner also ended up shooting his own child in the hand during the melee. The police state that the church's pastor, 61, grabbed Mintner and was subsequently shot in the leg. Members of the congregation grabbed Mintner and was able to wrestle the gun away from him before he ran out of the church screaming, "It's a white man made me do it, man. The white man made me do it." Fled the church on foot, leaving his car at the scene of the crime because he forgot it, I guess, and was captured by police less than a mile away from the Oasis Tabernacle Church. That's where Jesus hangs out, okay? If you don't believe it, just ask me. So the Black Ku Klux Klan is on the move again, boys and girls. Well, let's go to my most favorite subject, the subject of Jesus. And from the Jesus Never Existed profile and program, here we go, baby. This makes me happy. Speak, Almighty.
The one thing that we can all agree about the so-called miracles of Jesus is that they are an eclectic mix of exorcisms, healings, and triumphs over nature. There's one thing that's always struck me as rather odd, that the co-creator of the universe knows nothing about the germ theory of disease and is very much in the business of expelling malevolent demons from the sick. Now, Christian apologists, rather than recognize that this mixed bag of fantastic happenings has nothing more than a grab bag at the bazaar, instead will tell you that the very variety of these happenings is evidence of multiple attestation of Jesus' extraordinary ability. In that twilight zone of inverted logic in which Christian apologists exist, the lack of all consistency becomes perversely proof of the authenticity of the stories. How does Jesus cure blindness, for example? The Gospels tell us that the blind man, Bartimaeus, was cured simply by the command from Jesus. Yet the blind man from Bethsaida was cured by Jesus spitting in his eyes. And then again, the two blind men at Jericho were cured by faith. By golly, such inconsistency must be proof of the truth of the stories. Now, most rational minds, even Christian ones, have difficulty with this stuff and reduce the nonsense to supposed exaggeration of a core story, which they would suggest is the cure of psychosomatic disorders by a charismatic healer. The logic would go something like this. Brought into the presence of an immensely famous holy man, the adrenaline rush would dispel an illness that was really the result of hysteria and psychosis. Now, although this is plausible, it isn't actually supported by the gospel story. Jesus' first healing miracle is of Peter's mother-in-law, who is cured of a fever, in this case, by being lifted up. Now, we're told that same evening, Jesus cured many diverse diseases. So, where was any opportunity for a fantastic reputation to build? Jesus, in fact, cures straight out of the starting gate. The truth is, the collection of miracle stories were copied and concocted by the early church to boost the standing of their fabricated God-man and beat the claims of the competition. How curious that Jesus turns water into wine. Scarcely a noble or moral act, but precisely what the priests of Dionysus, the god of wine, claim for their own god. How curious that Jesus calms the storm and walks on water, scarcely acts beneficial to mankind, but within the power of Poseidon, the god of the sea. All the miracles of Jesus have precedence in Hebrew scripture, but they address the particular concerns of the writers of the Jesus yarn. The starting point for all of them is that the script for the Messiah requires signs and wonders which herald the kingdom of God. You can read in the book of Isaiah that the blind shall see, the deaf shall hear, the lame shall jump, and the dumb shall sing, and the dead shall rise. Scripture required these signs, so the gospel writers certainly provided them. Unfortunately for the evangelists, they couldn't change what had been already written about the Christ by an earlier generation of Christians. Not Paul, not James, not Clement, not any of the early letter writers say a word about the miracles of Jesus. When Paul argues with doubters about the resurrection of the dead, he says not a word about Lazarus or the daughter of Jairus. In 1 Corinthians, in fact, Paul actually scoffs at Jews who expected to see signs. And signs there were not. They are inventions, they are not history, they are just more astounding rubbish from the New Testament. The Jesus yarn, in its entirety, is a miracle story. All the way from that fantastical birth to a virgin to the ascension into the sky of the risen Christ. But there are around 36 purported events said to be the miracles of Jesus, and behind a number of these alleged happenings we see not the fulfillment of prophecy or even the manifestation of divine judgment, but simply a blatant attempt by the gospel writers to negate the competition. One such example is the healing of a man blind from birth, a story found only in the Gospel of John. This supposed miracle occurs at the pool of Siloam, at the foot of the eastern hill in Old Jerusalem. The target of John's Jesus miracle is nothing less than the parent faith of the new Christian heresy, Judaism itself. Let me sketch in for you the background to the venue. Running south from the hill of Temple Mount is a spur of high ground, sometimes called the Offal Ridge. It's about the size of a couple of football pitches. Because of a natural spring, later called the Gihon, which rises in a cave within the ridge, the very first people ever to settle the area, the Bronze Age Canaanites, built their first small town on the ridge. In the Bible mythology, it was this town that was captured by the Israelites and became the so-called City of David. A 7th century BC Jewish king Hezekiah built a tunnel that meanders for about 1500 feet under the ridge to carry the water of the Gihon spring and protect this vital water source, which terminates in the Pool of Siloam. So important was the precious water that it gave rise to a rain festival among the original Canaanites, which was later adapted by the Jews and restyled as the Feast of Tabernacles. During this festival, the priests carried the living water of Siloam up to the Temple Mount itself, where they sprinkled it on their altars, paraded about with palm fronds, and appealed to God for rain in the coming year. Thus, the waters of Siloam and the Festival of Tabernacles were at the heart of Judaism. And that's why the Gospel of John decides Jesus has to upstage the tradition with a mighty miracle from his God-man. To make the supersession very clear, John's Jesus describes himself as the source of living water, and that if any man thirst, he should come to him to drink, bizarre as that may seem. But of course, it is all symbolism, just like the original festival. But now, let's look at the miracle itself. The blind man is blind from birth. And the naive disciples, aware that disease is the result of sin, ask Jesus, who was the sinner, the man himself or his parents? Now here's the really good part. Jesus says neither. The man has been blind from birth so that Jesus could come along one day and work a miracle. That's something to remember when someone tells you what a great guy Jesus is. This is how he performs the miracle. He doesn't just touch the man's eyes, the way Jesus cured blindness in Matthew's yarn. He makes patties with mud and spit and places them on the man's eyes. But that doesn't cure the man's blindness. Jesus sends the man off to the Pool of Siloam. Only after washing away the mud patties can the man see. So what are we to make of all this? The first clue is that the miracle takes place both on a Sabbath and, you guessed it, during the Feast of Tabernacles. The man is a symbolic Jew, not a sinner per se, but nonetheless blind from birth to the divine truth. But by obeying Jesus, the Jew both sees the light and imbibes the living waters of Christ. Unbelieving Jews doubt the miracle. The Pharisees are divided, his parents fear the Jews, and the man himself calls upon others to become, like himself, disciples of Jesus. And those nasty Jews cast the man out. In this supposed miracle, we see all the 9 yards of the Christian mission and its hostility towards Judaism. It battles to win converts, and it gives them an example of recovering sight or seeing the truth with a yarn of a mighty deed and a didactic purpose. But of course it isn't true, it isn't history, it's just more amazing rubbish from the New Testament. Is a crutch for those who need a sky daddy. If you believe in him, you are deluding yourself. My name is Ken Humphreys. I'm an atheist, and I'm a writer on the subject of Jesus. Jesus is given credit where no credit is due. His so-called philosophy is neither original nor profound. The statements you find put into the mouth of Jesus can be found in the Greek philosophers and elsewhere long before the time of Jesus. And they said that message far more eloquently. Jesus' statements are simplistic, they are arbitrary, and many of them are quite dangerous. For example, Jesus preaches the sentiments of submission. He praises the idea of being humble in spirit, not bold in spirit, but humble in spirit. It's the religion of passivity and acceptance in the face of tyranny. If you're hit, you should turn the other cheek. We know those sentiments, but are they realistic? Are they practical? Can we honestly love our enemies when our enemies plant bombs in our cities? This is ridiculous. You know, the sentiments of Jesus are neither relevant nor valuable. It's time we put away this nonsense about Jesus and put away the claims made for him. He's past his sell-by date.
So there, quit being afraid of dying. We all gotta die. Most religion is based upon fear of death. I think most people fear the pain of death, not death. So what? Go to sleep. Bye-bye. Well, let's close out today with a little spiel by the Pope of the Church of what's happening now. Yeah. Would you like to become a minister of the Church of what's happening now, or Tommy's favorite church? Well, let me know.
Cars and driving. You want to go for a ride? Okay, let's go for a ride. Actually, you'll go for a ride. I'll go for a drive. The one who drives the car goes for a drive. The other person goes for a ride. Most folks aren't aware of that. Tell them when they're getting into your car. Say, you assholes are going for a ride, I'm going for a drive, because I'm the one who's making the payments on this shit box. Now, for purposes of description, you'll have to picture my car, an old, poorly maintained, dangerous collection of faulty parts from that wonderful time before safety became such a big goddamn deal in this country. My car's like any other small car, real hard to get into. That's important, because after all, you gotta get into the car first. Otherwise, the way I look at it, you ain't going nowhere. And let's not forget, with any kind of car, just opening the driver's door and getting in involves a certain amount of risk. Have you noticed that? The terrific way they designed cars so the driver's door opens right out into the middle of goddamn traffic. Jesus, about the only intelligent thing the British ever did was putting that driver's seat right over there near the curb where it belongs. Of course, then they went and moved the curb to the wrong side of the street. Anyway, like I said, no small car is easy to get into, but especially if you park the way I do. Illegally, 2 feet out from the curb on a busy high-speed thoroughfare right in the middle of rush hour. And that sort of car entry is even riskier if you got a two-door and you're trying to stuff a couple of shopping bags full of groceries into the back seat while everyone else is zipping past you close enough to smell your breath. Holy shit, look out, here comes a drunken bus driver. Quick, abandon groceries. Stand up straight, squeeze against the car, and pull that door as close to your body as you can, taking care, of course, not to cut off circulation to your feet. Holy shit, that was close. Good thing you went into emergency mode. And be honest, you didn't really need them groceries, did you? God damn, look at how flat that bus made everything. Imagine a flank steak with tread marks. And might that just possibly be potato juice on the ground? One more thing about car entry. My car has got one of them tricky kind of door handles, the kind that are recessed a little bit into the door itself. You know the ones I mean, where your fingers actually go in a little bit past the surface of the car till you grab a hold of the handle. Don't you like them? I do. That's why they don't make them anymore. They found out I like them. That's the way it is with everything. They find out I like it, they stop making it. Anyway, back to my car. I also got me one of them doors that when you open it, it swings all the way open. You know the kind I mean? All the way open, perpendicular to the car. I ain't got one of them fancy doors that hangs out there halfway and stays where you want it to. With my door, we got 2 things, open and shut. Pick one. And if I should be trying to do something really tricky, like get into the car? Well, in a case like that, I gotta prop that door open with a broom handle. Because otherwise, sure as hell, soon as I'm halfway in, that door's gonna swing back hard as it can and sever my leg just below the knee. Yeah! God, that shit hurts. Hurts for about a year and a half, don't it? and them huge purple blotches seems like they never go away. Now, I want to mention one additional problem I have when I'm getting into my car. Like I told you, it's kind of old and upkeep has been minimal, so there's another thing I got to deal with. A long time ago, my driver's seat got pushed way up forward on the runners, about as far as it can go, and apparently it ain't never coming back. You see, what happened was, years ago, about 30 or 40 of them little pop-top beer can rings got wedged into the seat tracks, and now they're all fused into one solid piece of metal, and that fucking seat ain't never going to move again. Unless, of course, there's an atomic attack, in which case it probably ain't going to budge more than an inch or two. So, because of all this unintentional seat redesign, when I get into full driving mode, I'm pretty much hanging out right behind the radiator. In fact, if I want to check my speedo, I got to look straight down into my crotch. But hey, at least I'm in the car. But maybe you're not. Maybe I ought to mention one more common car re-entry problem. I know that some of you faint-hearted folks like to play it safe by parking right in the mall parking lot. And of course, when you park the car, you do so in such a manner that leaves you full access to the door. But while you're in the mall charging all that worthless merchandise, some asshole parks right next to you, leaves about 6 inches between cars, and now you can't get your door open more than 3 or 4 degrees at best. So, in order to gain access, you gotta try to wedge yourself through a tiny little crack while balancing 6 gift-wrapped packages all the time, maintaining the integrity of a lit cigarette hanging off your lip. Besides which, your own particular lumbar spine is not the best one God ever put together, and everybody knows that even a proper back is not made for getting into a car under circumstances such as these. And by the way, as most men know, trying to squeeze into a car in that manner also creates a potential for serious ball injury from the steering wheel. Many's the family planning program that's gone out the window due to poor parking. Solution? Always park way down at the far end of the parking lot where the homeless people live. Your back and your balls will thank you, and the walk will do you good. Anyway, at this point, I think we're all in the car, so now I'll just reach over here, and I'll just reach over here. Oh, shit, goddamn door is still wide open. Well, maybe if I lean way out and stretch my arm as far as it'll go, maybe without actually getting up, I can actually reach out and... fuck it. It appears, folks, that today we're going to be driving with the door wide open. What the heck, it's a lovely day, and they say an open driver's door actually helps a little bit on left-hand turns. Acts like a rudder, increasing the drag factor on the port side. Okay, now we're going to be taking our little drive in just a minute or two here, but first a philosophical question. Have you ever noticed that when you're driving, anyone going slower than you is an idiot, and anyone going faster than you is a maniac? Will you look at this idiot? Look at him, just creeping along. Whoa, holy shit, look at that maniac go. Well, I tell you, folks, it's a wonder we ever get anywhere at all with all the idiots and maniacs out there, because no one ever drives at my speed. Actually, I don't let people drive at my speed. If I see some guy in the next lane keeping pace with me, I slow down. I let that asshole get a little bit ahead so I can keep an eye on him. I like to know who I'm driving near. In fact, quite often at a red light, I'll ask for personal references. You can never be too careful. Okay, now, a few basic points about driving. One of the first things they teach you in driver's ed is where to put your hands on the steering wheel. They tell you to put them at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. Never mind that shit. I put mine at 9:45 and 2:17. Gives me an extra half hour to get where I'm going. Now, most drivers know that some things that happen in the car can cause great embarrassment. I've never done any of these things myself, of course, but I'm sure you'll recognize a few of them. Here's a good example. You ever been driving someone else's car, and for some reason they're in the car too? You know what I mean? Let's say they got pushed off the balcony of a crack house and broke both their ankles, and they can't drive. So you're taking them out to buy some crack. You're driving their car, but you're used to driving your car, and their gear shift handle is mounted on the opposite side from where yours is, and suddenly you go to shift gears and break their fucking turn signal off. Just break it clean off the steering column. Holy shit, came right off, didn't it? God damn, you'll have to get a new one of them. Here, throw this old sucker out the window. It ain't no good to you now. Shit, that broke easy, didn't it? Some things break easy. Just break right off. Like radio dials. The old kind. The knob kind. Damn, those things were fragile. You'd be driving along just trying to tune in something on the radio. Trying to find some kind of music you could actually tolerate. And you'd just keep turning and turning and turning that dial until finally you got way over onto the right-hand side of the dashboard and ran clean out of radio stations and then... Holy shit, came right off, didn't it? God damn, gotta throw that mother away. Give me a fresh one out of that little bag, will you? I got about 50 of those motherfuckers. Damn, they break easy. So you stick a new knob onto the radio and keep turning and turning and turning until finally you wind up past the glove compartment listening to some radio station located over near the right-hand mirror. Damn, some things break easy. I'm a great believer in using every piece of equipment on the car. Every feature, every option, even if you don't need it. Fuck it. You paid for the car. Use everything. Use the sun visor, even on a cloudy day. Flip it up, flip it down. Flip it over to the side like the French people do. Lower the passenger's visor, even if no one is sitting there. Open the ashtray, push in the lighter. Who cares if you don't smoke? Turn all the knobs, press all the buttons. Have a lot of fun. Change the mirrors all around. Press the trunk release, pop the hood open. Put your seat in a ridiculous position. Lower all the windows. Stick out your hand. Tell the other drivers to slow down. You have power. Use hand signals. Tell them to slow down, slow down. And then tell them to stop, stop, stop. Then let one guy go. Only one. Okay, you can go. Go, go, go. No, not you. Just him. Okay, now you. Go, go, go. You have power. Use it. Fuck it. You're making the car payments. Have a little fun.
Well, boys and girls, I'll put my Pope up against the big Pope from Rome any day. My Pope's got more IQ than that Pope from Rome ever had. We'll see you tomorrow, 14-5. Ha, ha, ha.